Third case for argument this morning is Avila v. City Mortgage. Mr. Orlovsky.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jonah Orlovsky. I'll be representing the appellants. We have two theories of liability here. One is that there was a breach of fiduciary duty and a failure to use the insurance proceeds as prescribed in the document. And the same is language supports a breach of contract theory. Both of those theories arise out of the language in the contract that dictates how the mortgage, how the insurance proceeds are to be used.
Mr. Orlovsky, I understand your theory of liability. I'm not sure I see a theory of damages. The bank took $100,000, used it to pay down the debt, and of course that produced exactly $100,000 worth of benefit to the borrower. What's the theory of injury here?
Yeah, well, I would challenge that it produces obviously $100,000 in damages, and the problem is there is no record developed on that. We have pled that this has caused economic damage.
The bank reduced the debt by $100,000. That reduced the amount your client owes. That is a direct benefit to your client. Where's the loss?
Because I'm arguing simply without a benefit of having any development in the record on this, but a property without a house is not worth as much. The benefit, the detriment from not allowing this house to be repaired far out exceeds the benefit of having the mortgage paid down.
I don't understand the concept of not allowing the house to be repaired. The bank didn't obstruct your client for repairing the house.
They had no means to do so without the insurance
process. Why not? With the debt reduced by $100,000, it would have been easy to borrow an extra $100,000 and repair the house yourself.
And that's making a lot of assumptions on behalf of people of minimal means. These people did not have
means. My assumption is just that money is fungible, which is an assumption that underlies a whole lot of legal documents.
Money is fungible, but that does not mean the value of the property did not go down by more than the amount of the mortgage that was reduced.
If the value of the property went down by more than $100,000, then it would have been worth everyone's while, your client, the bank, any other potential lender, to spend the $100,000 and improve it. The fact that nobody did that suggests that it's not true.
Well, the fact that the bank did not do that is different than the fact that my clients did. They did not have the wherewithal to do that. It's not the same. You can't just say that clients can go to a bank and get $100,000 loans to fix a house. There's also, by the way, rental.
It's done every day.
Well, not among people
banks
of those kind of means.
Banks are asked to put up $100,000 to make, say, $200,000 worth of money. Very few people accuse banks of leaving profit on the table, and that seems to be what you're accusing City Mortgage of.
You know,
the bank could have improved its security by paying for these repairs and aiming its gun square at its foot. It pulled the trigger and injured itself. What sense does that make?
I wish I could assume in this mortgage crisis that all banks have acted so rationally. There are banks every day across the country pulling foreclosures on people when the houses are grossly underwater and the people are willing to pay. Banks do not make such rational decisions. They are big bureaucracies, and I don't think the bank made any decision here that the value of the house to be fixed would somehow create some value in their minds. They had money and they grabbed it, and that's all we know from the pleadings. So I would disagree sharply that there was any decision made like that. There was also rental. These people do not have a house to live in. They have to rent a home. That's a value that's not compensated for here. They're still renting. They've not been able to fix that house. Any further questions on that, Your Honor?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Let me highlight a few of the factual provisions of this mortgage agreement that I think are relevant to both theories. The first thing I wanted to highlight is that what the mortgage says specifically is that when the bank chooses to take the insurance proceeds, the bank shall, quote, hold them. The word is hold. And that hold is the word of escrow. It's the word that creates a fiduciary duty. It's not like the insurance company is paying these dollars to the bank and it's the banks to do with what they want. They're only allowed to hold the money to look and see what conditions are met. The second thing I want to point out in this provision is that it specifically provides that no interest or earnings are to be paid on these insurance proceeds. And I think that's almost showing the bank anticipating that perhaps some argument would be made about their duties in this case, but they specifically provided that unless law dictates otherwise, there'll be no earnings, even though they're holding these documents. So they protected themselves in that way.
But the bank is holding the proceeds of the insurance policy for its own benefit as a secured creditor. Isn't that what the document, the mortgage itself, states, rather than for the benefit of the borrower?
Yeah, I don't think so in this respect. The primary target of these funds is to go to the homeowner. There is a reversionary interest in case the home can't be fixed.
Right, that's a separate question under Section 5, but I'm looking at this, and you're focusing on your escrow argument, mm-hmm. I take it, your fiduciary duty argument. The problem with the fiduciary duty theory here is that the escrow is for the benefit of the bank as the secured lender.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between for whose benefit are these funds being held with the reason for the escrow. There's no question that the reason for the escrow is so that the bank can ensure that these monies are not wasted because they're being spent on money that secures its loan. But whose benefit are the funds being held for? That's the borrower. These are the borrower's insurance proceeds, and they're stepping in the middle as an intermediary to make sure that certain conditions are met before the borrower gets it. That doesn't mean these funds are being held for the bank's benefit. It means the escrow arrangement has been set up so the bank can make sure the funds are not misspent. I think the same thing operates if you look at the escrow agreement that works the other way. When the insurance premiums are paid to a bank, for example, for this policy and are put in escrow, and then the bank then pays them to the insurance carrier, that escrow agreement is also for the benefit of the bank to make sure the insurance proceeds are paid in a timely manner. The insurance premiums are paid in a timely manner. That's set up for the benefit of the bank to make sure the escrow agreement makes sure that the premiums reach the carrier in a timely fashion. But those insurance proceeds are being held for the benefit of the carrier. The bank is still getting between two parties. It's getting between the borrower and the insurance company and holding the funds to make sure some conditions are met. So the escrow agreement is set up to protect the bank, but that doesn't mean that funds aren't being held for the benefit of the borrower in this case. Make that distinction clear between why you've got an escrow. Whenever you have an escrow, it's there to protect somebody. Let's say you have a homeowner, and a homeowner puts some money in escrow, and it doesn't go to the seller right away. The buyer wants the money held in escrow. That escrow is there to protect the buyer, to make sure those funds don't go right away to the seller unless conditions are met. But the escrow person is holding those funds for the benefit of the seller. That's where those monies are eventually going to go.
Your breach of contract theory, which is your alternative theory here, mm-hmm. has to overcome your client's default.
Correct.
And how do you do that?
We do that on the basis of the fact that this is what the contract provides. This contract clearly contemplates the fact that there can be defaults by the borrower, and yet the borrower still has rights to those insurance proceeds. And just to make sure I'm clear exactly how that works, and then I'll explain why that's legally significant, the contract says that the borrower assigns all rights to the insurance proceeds in the event possession changes under Section 22 of the mortgage. There are a couple of conditions, but that's, I think, the most relevant one. Section 22 is the foreclosure provision, which says that if the borrower defaults, they have to get notice, they have to get an attempt to cure that notice, then there is a foreclosure proceeding, there is redemption period, and at the end of all that process, there can be a foreclosure sale where the property goes to the bank. The agreement says that only at the end of that process, when possession actually changes, does the borrower automatically, by contract, assign all of his or her proceeds to the bank. So that clearly implies that all of the prior steps, if there have been missed payments, if there's been a mortgage foreclosure action filed, the borrower has not lost any right to those insurance proceeds. So we have a contract that deals with the set of facts under which there has been a default and specifically says, no, the borrower doesn't lose the right to the insurance proceeds. That right has to be enforceable. I think that's no different than a provision in a contract that would say you waive consequential damages, you waive the right to a jury trial. The parties have the right, the ability to change their rights by contract. And the right they've changed here is that the borrower doesn't lose all rights because they miss a payment. It's explicit in the contract. I would point out, just to even emphasize how important that is, the contract provides, even if there is a change of possession through a foreclosure action, the bank still only gets the right to take so much of the insurance proceeds as will pay off the outstanding debt. If there's any excess insurance proceeds, that still goes to the borrower. Bank can't take a penny more than is owed. And I guess under the theory of the defendant in that situation, no, the bank could take all of the insurance proceeds, even if it was more than the debt, because the borrower has no rights to enforce these provisions relating to the insurance proceeds. So I don't see how it can be that the parties can't contract around that rule, the rule of law being that if you're in default, you can't enforce any rights under the contract. They've done it implicitly, not explicitly. I think the hypothetical I used in the brief was, what if the contract said, in the event of a default by the borrower can still sue for insurance proceeds, even if they've defaulted, and they won't be barred by the rule that says you can't bring a breach of contract action in the event you're in default. Would that be enforceable? I think yes, there's no question. I think implicitly this contract does the same thing. So I think it's also important to note that there are other rights that the borrower has, even in the event of a default. One thing, for example, the provision provides they do assign all of the proceeds of an insurance policy to the bank in the event possession changes hands, but they don't lose the right to unearned premiums. That's another protection that's built into this doctrine. In other words, if the policy is canceled in the middle of its term, the person who bought the insurance gets unearned premiums back. That's in Section 5. Once again, I guess the theory is that that is not an enforceable right, even though you have very detailed protections put into this Section 5 as to what would happen in the event of various kinds of default. And first of all, that's a protection only if there's been a complete change of possession, not as here. But even in a complete change of possession, the borrower has rights. It seems to me those provisions are enforceable. The parties are allowed to do that. They're allowed to say, in the event of a default, you still have rights. You only lose certain rights if possession changes. Now, I'll grant you, we don't have a case on all four square points with that, but I think the logic of it is very strong, because in a foreclosure proceeding, there are many rights that borrowers have after the foreclosure proceeding begins. That's an important part of the process. You have rights of redemption. You have periods when you can reinstate the loan. It's not final until the house is sold, although even after that you have some rights. So those rights, it's not surprising that a contract would provide rights to a borrower after the foreclosure process has been initiated. So what this contract does is consistent with the overall structure of a foreclosure proceeding. If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Orlovsky. Mr. Panoff.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Thomas Panoff on behalf of the defendant, Appellee City Mortgage. At issue in this putative class case are two causes of action under Illinois law, one for breach of fiduciary duty and one for breach of contract. Despite three opportunities to plead these causes of action in the district court, plaintiff has demonstrated that he cannot do so as a matter of Illinois law. So, switching gears, plaintiff has now raised new theories on appeal that were never raised in the district court in a hope to sidestep some of the issues that he ran into in the district court. But even if this court were to consider those new theories, it's clear that these causes of action fail, again, as a matter of Illinois law. So I'd like to turn first to the breach of fiduciary duty claim. It's undisputed under Illinois law that there is no fiduciary duty between a creditor and a debtor, in particular, in between a mortgagor and a mortgagee. Multiple cases have held that, including the Palmier case from this court. So given that there's not one as a matter of law, one might be implied, but only if certain factors exist, none of which exist here. So to create one, he would have to show, Mr. Avila would have to show, a substantial dominance by City Mortgage, that plaintiff placed his trust and confidence in City Mortgage, that City Mortgage accepted that trust and confidence, and he must show this by clear and convincing evidence under Illinois law. Again, despite three opportunities to plead this, he failed to do so. So they've now jettisoned that theory, and they come up with the new escrow theory. This was never raised in the district court at all, and it's certainly not contained in the face of any contract here. Even if this court were to consider this new theory for the first time on appeal, this too fails as a matter of law. An escrow requires a third party to hold funds for the benefit of another on the express conditioning or happening of an event. That's clearly not the case here. City Mortgage was one of the beneficiaries of the money, and it's not holding it for the benefit of another. It's holding it for its own interests. Thus, there's no escrow agreement as a matter of law. Third, There's no escrow agreement on the face of this contract, so plaintiff is now asking the court to impute one. But that doesn't make sense for one very important reason. In paragraph 3 of the mortgage contract, and this is a standard Freddie Fannie uniform instruments used across 50 states, tailored slightly to each state. But in this particular contract, as in most of the contracts, there is an escrow provision. It's plain as day. It says escrow items, and it delineates certain escrow items, such as taxes and assessments, leasehold payments, and insurance premiums. But missing from that category is insurance proceeds. So plaintiff is asking this court to create an escrow agreement when one doesn't exist and ignore that the parties were well aware of how to create an escrow agreement as they already did in this contract. Fourth, case law squarely rejects plaintiff's theory. That in the Hensler case, the Illinois Court of Appeals held that the handling of insurance proceeds does not create a fiduciary relationship. The cases that plaintiff cites are clearly off the mark. They talk about how particular escrow items as delineated in the contract are used. That's not the case here. So even if this court were to address the escrow theory for the first time on appeal, it's clear that this theory too fails as a matter of law. I'd like to turn quickly to plaintiff's breach of contract claim. This too also fails for numerous reasons. Under Illinois law, there are four elements for a breach of contract claim. The first one is that there be a valid and enforceable contract. No one disputes that here. The second is performance by the plaintiff. And then there must be a breach by the defendant and resulting injury to the plaintiff. So turning to the second item, which is performance, it's undisputed the plaintiff has defaulted on his mortgage here. He defaulted well in advance of the alleged breach. He defaulted well in advance of filing the suit. So that's not an issue. In fact, the proposed class that he is seeking to certify here is on behalf of a class of borrowers who themselves have all defaulted. So they're seeking to certify a class where they admit that one of the key elements is missing. Another thing we'd like to point out is, and we direct the court to our supplemental appendix, because this page of the contract was missing from the version that the plaintiff submitted to the court in his appendix. But paragraph 20 of the mortgage in our supplemental appendix says that before a plaintiff can institute a suit for breach of contract, he must give the defendant notice and an opportunity to cure. Plaintiff never alleged, nor could he, that he did so here. So even applying the plain terms of the contract, it's not just the default that renders him unable to file a breach of contract claim. It's also the fact that he hasn't complied with notice of cure. And in addition to that, there are a panoply of other requirements. Plaintiff's complaint is entirely silent as to those as well.
Was that defense pleaded?
Pardon me?
Was the notice defense pleaded or argued in the district court?
It was in our motion to dismiss on the third amended complaint. The second amended complaint, the third operative complaint in the issue. So plaintiff again comes up with a new theory. They're now getting around the fact that they've defaulted and have now brought up the election of remedies doctrine. But this doctrine...
Well, there is a contract-based defense that is separate from the election of remedies, and that is the question about whether the provisions of Section 5 of the mortgage with respect to the obligations that the bank has to the use of the proceeds of the insurance policy survive the default.
That might be, and it would go to the breach element, Your Honor, but at issue on the appeal is the performance element. And maybe if there was a misapplication.
We accept, as sure. We have to, that he defaulted. I think that's undisputed. And the question is whether the provisions of Section 5, which dictate the terms of the bank's handling of the proceeds of an insurance policy, whether those terms survive the default.
And they would, Your Honor. We would submit that they
and can be enforced by the borrower in a breach of contract action.
That's where we disagree. No, they can't. They are enforced, and the city then has an obligation to apply them as would any other borrower according to the terms. But plaintiff does forfeit that right to affirmatively bring a breach of contract claim. And this court has held that in the Hukic case that we cite. They cite that if a borrower has defaulted, he might have other rights that exist, and Mr. Orlovsky brought those up. There might be statutory rights, and paragraph 22 of the mortgage talks about other rights. But one right that he does lose is the affirmative ability to bring a breach of contract claim. The Hukic case from this court is incredibly clear on that, and dismissed the breach of contract claim on that ground alone. Now, in the Catalan case that this court issued, or in the opinion that this court issued, that the Hewkett case rule of law was modified slightly, but only there because there was a dispute as to which party breached first. Here it's undisputed that the plaintiff breached first. In fact, plaintiff's breach was a necessary condition to even get to the alleged breach by City Mortgage. So following this court's holdings in Hewkett and Catalan, it's very clear the plaintiff just does not have a breach of contract claim. That's not to say he doesn't have statutory rights or other rights that exist for any borrower, but you know, to borrow an analogy from property law, the bundle of sticks that exist here, affirmative breach of contract claim is not one of those sticks that's in his bundle anymore. And I would like to point out to Judge Easterbrook's question, we did raise the injury point below. Judge Guzman, this was in the first complaint, Judge Guzman ruled against us on that. He didn't offer any rationale. He just said that there was a breach that was plausibly alleged. But it was something that we had raised, and that's on page 34 of our brief as well, in footnote number 11. So at the end of the day, both causes of action have serious flaws, even if this court were to consider the new arguments raised for the first time on appeal. For all those reasons, we would respectfully ask that the court affirm the judgment below, unless the court has any additional questions.
Do you have a substantive response to the breach of contract argument?
Could Your Honor clarify the question?
Do you have a substantive response to the breach of contract, as apart from this, they can't bring the claim because he's defaulted?
Yes, there was no breach, Your Honor, in that, because it was very clear under the contract provisions that if the security would be lessened or if the repair was not feasible, then the insurance proceeds can be used to apply to the debt, to pay down the debt. Plaintiff never alleged that he hadn't made those determinations. So we're here on a motion.
Actually, no, the lender's right to use the proceeds to pay down the debt are conditioned on the abandonment of the property.
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. If you turn to paragraph 5 of
that's where I'm looking.
Okay. In the supplemental appendix, page 6, it says at the bottom, if the restoration or the repair is not economically feasible or the lender's security would be lessened, the insurance proceeds shall be applied to the sum secured by the security instrument, whether or not then due with the excess, if any, paid to the borrower. Such insurance proceeds shall be applied to the order provided for in Section 2. It then goes on to provide additional instances in which it can be applied. But paragraph 5 is very clear that if City Mortgage makes either of those two determinations, then it can also apply the proceeds to pay down the debt. So part of it is, we believe, a misapprehension of the way the contract works by plaintiffs.
Well, was a determination made that repair was economically infeasible or lessened the security interest?
There was, Your Honor. That's not before the court because we're here on a motion to dismiss.
All right, so that has not been litigated.
It has not been litigated. Plaintiff hasn't alleged that City Mortgage didn't make that determination, which we believe is...
Well, they've alleged a breach of contract, which
they don't have
to allege this specific...
But they haven't alleged this issue that City Mortgage hadn't made that determination. But the clear answer, Your Honor, is it's not before the court presently on this motion to dismiss.
But it's in the case if the issue of default falls away, either by virtue of the Catalan case or by virtue of the election of remedies doctrine.
It could be in the case. We're saying he hasn't pled that City Mortgage hasn't made the determination. So it was never at issue in his three pleadings. But we agree that if he were to replead, it would be an issue that would be litigated, Your Honor, yes. I'd like to thank the court for its time, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Panoff. Anything further, Mr. Orlovsky?
Yes.
You might have
a couple of brief
might have 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
One, we were never presented with the lack of notice defense, that we didn't give notice of the breach of contract. We never got a chance to plead about that defense. We didn't plead that the plaintiff complied with the contract because he had missed payments, but we never got to address the issue in the trial court at all, that there was a lack of notice. And the other thing is that the district court found that these allegations are sufficient to suggest that City breached the loss provision and plaintiff was damaged as a result. So the court found that there was a sufficient allegation that they did not make that finding. We didn't use the words didn't make the finding of economically infeasible, but certainly that's a fair inference, and that's certainly what we intended to plead, that no such a determination was ever made by the bank. That's a factual issue. I'm sure they dispute it, but certainly our pleading, I think, supports a claim that they did not make that determination. They simply applied the proceeds to pay off the bank. That's all, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.